Good morning, everyone. So Swami B is in India, Swami A is in Michigan, but we have a special guest, Dr. Jeffrey Long and Mava Bhattacharya. Most of us know them. They have been here multiple times, and they spoke during our Labor Day weekend retreats, and they are our dearest friends and family. And today's speaker, I'll introduce Dr. Jeffrey Long. He is a professor of religion and Asian studies at Elizabethtown College in Pennsylvania. And he teaches in Hinduism, Buddhism, and Jainism. And he represents across the world at different seminars and conferences in Hinduism, Buddhism, and Jainism, and gives lectures. And he also teaches the seminars on Star Wars, Asian philosophy, Sanskrit, and comparative theology and interfaith engagements. He has written a lot of books, and if you go on to Amazon and if you just look for Jeffrey Long's book and Wikipedia, you find a lot of books on him. Very interesting books, if you ever want to read. And he received his PhD from PhD and MA from University of Chicago in 1993. He received MA, and 2000 he received PhD from University of Chicago. And he received recently in 2018 an award from Hindu American Foundation Dharma Seva Award for his efforts to help mainstream American understand the Hinduism in academia and public schools. And with that, I would like to welcome Dr. Jeffrey Long to take over. Thank you.
Thank you for such a warm and kind welcome. And I always feel at home here. Donna, okay. Is that a little better? Okay. I don't want to be booming. Don't want to damage anyone's hearing today. So thank you for such a warm and kind welcome. Mahua and I always feel right at home when we're here. So thank you very, very much. So namaste, namaskar, and good morning. Today I'd like to explore the idea of the avatar, the divine incarnation, or more literally, divine descent, if we're to be true to the original Sanskrit meaning of the term. To my knowledge, the first appearance of this concept in Sanskrit literature is in the 7th verse of the 4th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. In this verse, Lord Krishna tells Arjuna, Yada yada hi dharmasya glanir bhavati bharata, abhyutanam adharmasya tadatmanam srijamyaham, which in English means, whenever dharma, the moral order of the universe, declines, and adharma, or chaos, arises, then do I manifest myself. In the verse which follows, Krishna explains that he manifests himself into the world in order to bring an end to chaos and evil and to restore dharma. Though the actual word avatar does not appear in the Gita, it is clear from the context of the tradition that this is the idea to which Krishna is referring. In the Bhagavata Purana and in other Hindu texts, the idea of the avatar is elaborated further, and lists of avatars are given. There are at least two lists of 10 avatars, another list of 24, and another of 108. It is also said that there are in reality countless avatars. Given the infinite cycles of existence through which the universe passes, according to Hindu teaching, as well as the existence of countless other universes, both as taught in Hindu texts and as postulated by contemporary physics, it stands to reason that the number of avatars would be potentially infinite, with divine manifestations appearing in each and every age of each and every cosmic cycle, as well as on countless worlds, that is, wherever and whenever dharma declines and adharma arises. Perhaps there are realms and regions and eras of history in which this never occurs, in which dharma never declines and adharma never arises, and so there is no need for such divine manifestations. But these regions would certainly not be the region of the cosmos where we reside, nor would it reflect the nature of history as we know it in this world as human beings. And I think we can all agree that there's plenty of adharma around. Right? The best way to understand the nature and function of the avatar is to examine the lives of such beings. The best known list of avatars is the list of 10, which includes Siddhartha Gautama, the Buddha, as its ninth member. And we have a picture of the Buddha right here. This seems to be a modification of an earlier list, which includes, instead of the Buddha, Balaram, the brother of Krishna. According to both lists, the first avatar is the Matsya, or fish avatar. Second is the Korma, or tortoise avatar. Third is the Varaha, or boar avatar. Fourth is the Narasimha, or man-lion avatar. Fifth is Vamana, or dwarf avatar. And sixth is Parashuram, or Ram with an axe, who's not to be confused with the seventh avatar, Ram, the hero of the Ramayana, and possibly the most popular of the 10 avatars, or Dashavatara. The eighth avatar, according to the earlier list, is Balaram, the brother of Lord Krishna, who's followed by Lord Krishna himself as the ninth. In the later list, the eighth avatar is Krishna, and the ninth is the Buddha. Finally, the tenth avatar, Kalki, is the avatar who is yet to come. Although it is incomplete, given that the avatars are virtually infinite in number, the list of 10 avatars, especially in its second version, holds very deep spiritual significance. According to Sri Aurobindo, the list of 10 avatars represents a condensed symbolic account of the evolution of consciousness in the material world. Aurobindo builds upon the work of Swami Vivekananda in his teaching that what we call from a materialistic perspective the evolution of consciousness is, from a spiritual perspective, the same process as the descent or involution of consciousness into the realm of matter. In other words, if we view the history of consciousness from the most simple life forms to human beings and beyond, from a material point of view, we see increasingly complex manifestations of consciousness emerging from simpler forms. If we limit ourselves to the material perspective, we're of course faced with the question of how it is that something as subtle and sophisticated as consciousness can have arisen from simple life forms, what Swamiji refers to as protoplasm, and even before that, from molecules and atoms. At least at our current stage of scientific knowledge, the answer we have is the rather unsatisfactory statement that this evolution has been the result of a series of fortuitous accidents. This is perhaps simply a way of saying that we do not know the answer to this question, or at least that no better answer has emerged that the scientific community has found persuasive. According to Vedanta, though, one can also view the process of evolution from the perspective of consciousness itself, taking consciousness rather than the material world as our starting point. From this perspective, what we've been calling an evolutionary process is actually an involutionary process, in which consciousness descends, as it were, into the realm of matter, emerging first in simple forms and then gradually manifesting its fuller potential in increasingly complex and subtle forms, culminating in the fully realized being or liberated soul, the Jivan Mukta. According to Sri Aurobindo, the ideal of the avatar or divine descent ultimately points to the descent or involvement of consciousness into the material world, where it manifests from a material point of view as the evolution of consciousness, starting with simple forms and moving to more complex ones. We begin then with the Matsya avatar, for life on earth as we know it did emerge first in the oceans, with some fish gradually moving to land, first taking on an amphibious existence, and finally becoming the land-dwelling creatures that we know today. Next comes the tortoise avatar. And sure enough, the first animals to live fully on dry land were those that we now know as reptiles. Next comes the boar avatar, Varaha, reflecting the fact that mammals have come after reptiles. Then there's the Narasimha, the man-lion, for human beings have evolved from other animal forms, and the man-lion represents an intermediate stage between what we might see as an animal existence and a properly human existence. The Vamana, or dwarf avatar, is sometimes compared to a child because of his appearance. He would thus represent humanity in its childhood, in its infancy, with human consciousness just starting to appear in the world. Then we have Parashuram, who is fully human, but who represents an earlier phase of civilization. This avatar is known for his great violence, slaying the entire warrior community when it has become corrupt. He thus represents an earlier, more violent phase of human evolution. With Ram, we have humanity at its finest, living by the precepts of Dharma, and while still engaged in violence for the purpose of saving the world from the evil Ravan, strongly tempering that violence with a sense of honor and fair play. Ram is the first avatar from this list who is aware of his divinity, though he only learns that he is a divine descent at the end of his story. For most of the Ramayana, he's unaware of this fact. He could be said to represent the dawning of spiritual consciousness in humanity. In the original list of 10 avatars, Balaram, the brother of Lord Krishna, is next. Balaram would be difficult, I would say, to represent as an additional stage of evolution. But it's significant that Balaram and Lord Krishna both lived at the same time. This tells us that avatars do not necessarily need to appear in succession. Divinity can manifest itself in many places at the same time. For God is not limited to the laws of time, space, and causation as we experience them. God can be many places at once, so there can be multiple avatars at the same time. In the revised list, which Sri Aurobindo uses, Lord Krishna is next after Ram. Krishna is, unlike all the previous avatars, fully aware of his divinity right from his infancy. He's therefore known as a Purnavatar, that is, a full or absolute avatar. Some of his most ardent devotees, in fact, say that it's not proper to think of him as an avatar at all, but as the Supreme Being himself. For Krishna does not speak of himself as an incarnation or manifestation, but as the Supreme Reality or Supreme Personality of Godhead. This seeming difference, though, can be resolved if we bear in mind that Krishna is a full avatar. The presence of the infinite is fully manifest in him. So to speak as though, in his case, the divine reality and its manifestation are two different things is to quibble over minor details. True, Krishna had a body, which was born at a particular point in time, had human parents, and died when struck in the foot by a hunter's arrow. But the spiritual essence of Krishna was the Paramatman itself, with no differentiation from the Supreme Being who maintains and upholds the cosmos. As Sri Ramakrishna has said, seeing an incarnation of God is the same as seeing God himself. This is certainly the case with Krishna. One might ask, what is there beyond such an absolute manifestation of divinity as Krishna? Why is any other avatar needed? Next in the list, though, comes the Buddha, who, Sri Aurobindo tells us, deliberately forgets his divinity so he can rediscover it, thereby showing humanity the path to God realization. As a full avatar, Lord Krishna did not need to practice any sadhana, as he was already the Supreme Being. His purpose on earth was different from that of Buddha and the other avatars. The Buddha's purpose, though, was to show human beings the way to freedom from suffering. In order to do this, he had to suffer himself, and then seek and find the solution to suffering. This required him to set aside his divine nature so it could manifest in his life and works. This brings to mind several things. In 2012, I was privileged to hear a wonderful lecture at Belarmat by Swami Bhajananda, in which he described the non-dual realization, the realization of one's own divinity, as the peak of spiritual experience. He went on, though, to say that if one has reached the peak, one has only reached the halfway point of one's journey. If we climb to the top of the mountain, we're not finished with our task. We still need to climb back down the mountain and return home. Right? All the great mountain climbers who don't come back, we don't regard those as successes, right? This image reminded me of a Buddhist story represented in the Zen tradition with 10 pictures in which a man is searching for his ox. The pictures tell a story, so this man is looking for his ox. The ox represents enlightenment, the highest realization. Each of the 10 pictures represents a phase in the search for enlightenment. The actual experience of enlightenment, though, is only the 8th of the 10 phases. The journey is not over until the seeker returns to his village, riding on his ox with open hands, ready to serve humanity. Returning to Swami Bhajananda's image, we need to come down from the mountain peak, the realization of our divinity, and share this realization with the rest of the world. The transition from the Krishna avatar to the Buddha avatar represents the move from the highest realization to the stage of sharing that realization with all beings. For according to both Vedanta and Buddhism, we are all one, and our own realization is not complete if it's not shared with others, contributing to the realization of all. If I think about my realization, your realization, I'm misguided because we are all ultimately connected. This is why, according to Mahayana Buddhism, some beings, known as bodhisattvas, do not leave the cycle of rebirth immediately upon attaining realization, but choose to stay and help other beings attain realization as well. And it is also why, according to the Vedanta tradition, the divine reality descends into the world again and again. Even liberated beings like Shankaracharya chose to remain embodied and share their knowledge with others, even after attaining realization. And the Buddha similarly remained embodied, sharing his Dharma, his truth, with others for another 45 years, long after attaining realization under the Bodhi tree at Bodh Gaya. Finally, the Kalki avatar, the avatar who is yet to come, can be seen to represent the fact that the process of divine involution is never complete, so long as we are in the realm of time and space and causation. Until we become liberated, and there is for us no longer a realm of time, space, or causation, there will always be another avatar yet to come in the future. And in fact, Swami Vivekananda says something similar about religions, which are started by great avatars. He honors all the religions of the past, the present, and the future, because this process will continue on. Setting aside for a moment the evolutionary and involutionary aspect of the ten avatars, what else can we say about these beings based on the information we receive about them in sacred Hindu writings? If we look again to what Lord Krishna tells us in the Gita, the Supreme Being manifests in the world whenever dharma declines and needs to be restored, whenever the moral order begins to collapse and chaos arises. Each of the ten avatars plays some role in restoring the good when it is threatened by evil. Most typically, this evil is represented by demonic beings, that is, beings who embody demonic or asuric qualities, such as arrogance, egotism, and a boundless desire for wealth, power, and sensory pleasure, even this if this means at the expense of others. Qualities described in the 16th chapter of the Gita. The Matsya or fish avatar saves humanity from a natural disaster in the form of a great flood. In an interesting contrast with the biblical flood, the flood from which the fish avatar saves humanity is not sent as a punishment for sin. It's just a great flood, a natural disaster. The divine role in the story is not to punish humanity, but to save humanity. One could argue, perhaps, that it must have been the karma of the people who perished in the flood that brought this disaster upon them. But we're also told in the Vedanta tradition that we must be careful about passing moral judgment on others based on their apparent bad karma. Sometimes, in fact, we suffer not so much because we've done something wrong, but in order to become stronger and to gain in spiritual insight. As Swami Vivekananda says, in studying the great characters the world has produced, I dare say in the vast majority of cases, it would be found that it was misery that taught more than happiness. It was poverty that taught more than wealth. It was blows that brought out the inner fire more than praise. The Korma or tortoise avatar allows himself to become the pivot that the devas and the asuras use to churn the elixir of life, the amrita, from the cosmic ocean. Here too we see an avatar manifesting for the purpose of bringing life into the world, of rescuing living beings from death. The remaining avatars, though, engage directly in combat with demonic forces, either with demonic beings or with human beings who've given themselves over to these forces. In the case of the boar avatar, Varaha, the demonic forces are represented by Hiranyaksha, who torments the earth itself. One can see an ecological message in this story as well, with Mother Nature herself, the earth goddess Bhudevi, being in need of rescue from the forces of unbridled greed in the form of Hiranyaksha's desire to dominate her. The Narasimha, or man-lion, similarly fights with and destroys Hiranyakashipu, and Vamana the dwarf stands upon and crushes the demonic Mahabali, whose name means one with great power. The power of delusion, of ego, is indeed great and needs to be stamped down by the wisdom of the higher self. We also see this theme in the iconography of Lord Shiva as Nataraj, Lord of the Cosmic Dance, who also stands on the ego and tramples it down. And in the stories of the goddesses Durga and Kali, as they too conquer demonic forces. Ram, too, the seventh avatar, destroys the demonic Ravan, bringing an end to his reign. Parashuram fights with and destroys human beings who have become consumed by lower forces, in his case, the corrupt warrior class. And finally, Lord Krishna defeats first his wicked uncle, Kansa, and then the Kauravas, who've also become demonic through their greed and their dishonorable behavior, as narrated in the Mahabharata. The Buddha, we could say, while not a literal demon slayer, teaches his followers the way to overcome the inner enemies of greed, hatred, and delusion, raga, dvesha, moha. These, as Lord Krishna tells Arjuna in the Gita, are our true enemies, even more so than the mortal beings whom we encounter who are overcome by these evil tendencies, tendencies to which we ourselves are subject. I wish to turn now from a discussion of the Dashavatara to a discussion of three avatars in particular, each of whom belongs to our era of recorded history, and each of whom stands at the origin point of a great spiritual tradition. I will begin with the Buddha, whom I've already mentioned, for he is also one of the 10 avatars listed in the Hindu sacred texts. I've long seen the inclusion of the Buddha as an avatar, as I believe many of us have, as an example of the Vedantic teaching of the harmony of religions. It has certainly become this, as it has long been a mainstream view of many Hindus that the Buddha was a great spiritual teacher and one certainly worthy of the honor of being proclaimed an avatar. Interestingly, though, one of the earliest accounts of the Buddha avatar is part of an anti-Buddhist polemic. It is said that Lord Vishnu descended to the earth as the Buddha to deceive demonic persons of his time into not performing Vedic rituals. Many Hindu stories refer to demons performing Vedic rituals or performing tapasya or asceticism, and thereby achieving great power. Ravan, for example, received his immunity from attacks by all creatures except human beings due to an ascetic vow to Lord Shiva that he undertook and completed successfully. The Buddha avatar, it is said, deceives his demonic followers into not performing Vedic ritual, thereby making them vulnerable to destruction. Now, what should we make of this negative interpretation of Buddhism? As Sri Ramakrishna has said, the scriptures contain a mixture of sand and sugar. One finds in many scriptures of the world's great spiritual traditions profound insight, as well as evidence of jealousy and rivalry among sects. We always need to be wary of that within the scriptures, which tends toward, in the words of Swami Vivekananda, sectarianism, bigotry, and its horrible descendant, fanaticism. One always needs to be attentive to the complete context in which certain statements are found. Thus, if one is attentive to the textual traditions of Hinduism as a whole, one finds far more positive statements about the Buddha than negative ones. In Jayadeva's Gita Govinda, for example, it is said that the Buddha avatar only taught his followers to avoid those Vedic rituals that caused harm to living beings, the animal sacrifices that have been enjoined in certain rituals and in certain regions and during certain periods of history. Indeed, Swami Vivekananda taught that there was nothing in the Buddha's doctrine contrary to the higher teachings of Vedanta as found in the Upanishads, even as he rejected some aspects of the more ritualistic practice of the Vedas. According to Swami Vivekananda, quote, Buddha brought the Vedanta to light, gave it to the people, and saved India. To be sure, Buddhism itself, at least in all its forms, does not teach that the Buddha was an avatar. He is seen rather as an extraordinary human being who achieved the highest possible state of spiritual awakening. In what is widely believed to be the oldest of Buddhist traditions, the Theravada tradition, predominant in countries like Sri Lanka, Myanmar, and Thailand, this is the case. The Buddha would thus be not an avatar, but the equivalent of a jivanmukta, one who has attained awakening and liberation. Indeed, this tradition does not even speculate about the existence of a divine supreme being who might descend from time to time to the material world. The Mahayana Buddhist tradition, though, comes very close to the teaching of Vedanta regarding the nature of the Buddha. Buddha nature, the capacity for awakening, is present in all of us according to this tradition. This is close to the potential divinity of all beings which Vedanta teaches. A Buddha is a being in whom this capacity has manifested fully. In fact, there are even Mahayana texts which speak of the infinite Buddha nature taking on the form of a living being in order to teach and show others the path to awakening, and which also state that Shakyamuni, or Siddhartha Gautama, the Buddha of history, was one such manifestation. So it's very similar to the idea of the avatar. As Vedantins, we must show respect for the beliefs of others and not insist to them that the sacred figure they revere as their teacher and guide is something other than what they take him to be. We can see, though, from our Vedantic point of view, the idea of the Buddha avatar is capturing an important truth, that divinity is capable of veiling itself and the fullness of its capacities in order to take on a mortal form, and through this form, in every other way exactly like our own, to show us through a lived example the path to God realization. And in the reading group on Friday, we actually read from the gospel where Sri Ramakrishna talked about the ego of devotion and the ego of knowledge that these beings take on temporarily in order to interact with the rest of us in the world. As Christmas draws nearer, our sisters and brothers in the Christian tradition prepare to celebrate the manifestation in time, space, and history of a being whom they proclaim as divine and who can also be seen from a Vedantic perspective as an avatar or divine descent, who came with a mission like that of the Buddha of showing living beings the path to spiritual freedom. And we have his picture also here in the temple. Growing up as I did in the Christian tradition, I was taught from a very early age to regard Jesus Christ as divine. In the Roman Catholic tradition in particular, in which I was raised, it is taught that Jesus is the second person of the Holy Trinity, God the Son. The Christian doctrine of the Trinity is in fact akin in many respects to Hindu concepts of divinity. In both traditions, it can be said that divinity is both one and many, one supreme Godhead with many forms or aspects. In the Hindu tradition, this of course takes the form of the Trimurti, God as simultaneously creator or Brahma, preserver or Vishnu, and the one who destroys the old to make way for the new, or Shiva, as well as the corresponding Shaktis or goddesses who accompany each of these, Saraswati or divine wisdom, Lakshmi or divine mercy, and she who is variously known as Uma, Devi, Parvati, Durga, Kali, or most fundamentally Shakti or divine power. Among these, it is Vishnu who manifests in the realm of time, space, and causation in the form of his many avatars to do his work of preserving the cosmic order, or dharma, by bringing an end to the forces of chaos. In the Christian tradition, one supreme Godhead takes the form of the Father, or Creator, the Son, through whom the world is made and by whom it is brought back into harmony with the Father, and the Holy Spirit, which is the divine presence in the world and in each one of us. To draw an absolute correlation between the persons of the Christian Trinity and the deities of Hinduism is difficult, though some similarities can be seen. The Son of God, like Lord Vishnu, is the one who manifests into the world to reestablish the good and bring about an end to the demonic forces of chaos, which always seek to undermine the cosmic order. One important difference, perhaps the difference, between the Christian and Hindu visions of divine manifestation is, at least for mainstream Christianity, Jesus Christ is the one and only such manifestation, the way, the truth, and the life, as it says in the gospel. Faith in whom is a necessity for the attainment of salvation. This is in sharp contrast with the teaching of the Gita, where Krishna proclaims that whenever dharma, the moral order of the universe, declines, and adharma or chaos arises, then do I manifest myself. That is, Krishna does not appear only once in the cosmos, but whenever his divine presence is needed. So there can be many divine manifestations, even as there is only one supreme divinity. Even if one sees Lord Krishna as Purnavatar, and so virtually identical with the Godhead itself, this does not mean that other manifestations are to be rejected, or that those who place their faith in these manifestations are lost or misguided. Lord Krishna also tells us in the 11th verse of the 4th chapter of the Gita, "In whatever way living beings approach me, thus do I receive them. All paths lead to me." As I was growing up in the Christian tradition, its teaching of the necessity of faith in Jesus Christ alone disturbed me deeply. The heart of Jesus' teaching, I felt, and was told repeatedly, was that, quote, "God is love, and whoever abides in love abides in God, and God in him." From the first letter of John, chapter 4, verse 16. Many Christians, however, deduce from the teaching that faith in Jesus is necessary for salvation, that all those who are not Christian are damned for eternity, that after this life they will suffer an eternal torment. Given that most people quite naturally adhere to the religious tradition in which they grew up, and that most people throughout history have not been Christian, with many never even hearing of Christianity, this would mean that most people are going to hell. And given that God is held to be the all-knowing creator of all beings, this almost also means that God created billions of people knowing that they would spend infinite time in eternal torment. Such a God, it seemed to me, was not only not loving, but psychopathically cruel. Now, according to Swami Vivekananda, and we were just reading this yesterday, it is necessary for God to appear in human form because it's otherwise impossible for us as human beings to relate to God in God's absolute sense. If it is indeed necessary for God to appear to us in human form in order to reunite us with him, in order to close the gap between us and the divinity underlying all things, it seemed to me that God would appear many times to many different people and in many different cultures and regions of the world, so that all beings would have the opportunity to learn the truth and reach salvation. And because I've always been a fan of science fiction, with a love for astronomy and physics, it seemed to me that given the vastness of this universe, plus the extremely high likelihood that intelligent life forms are on many different worlds, God would also manifest on those worlds, in forms that those people could recognize and through whom they could reach God as well. If God is love, this must be the case. Indeed, I thought, why should there not be divine manifestations for all species? In the words of Swamiji, quote, suppose a cow were philosophical and had religion. It would have a cow universe and a cow solution to the problem, and it would not be possible that it should be our God. Suppose cats became philosophers. They would see a cat universe and a cat solution to the problem and a cat ruling it. Why not a cat God? Why not a cow God? How then ought the Christian claim that Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life to be understood? We could again recall Sri Ramakrishna's teaching that the scriptures contain a mixture of sand and sugar. We could then conclude, perhaps, that the teaching that Jesus is the one divine manifestation is a pernicious dogma inserted into the scripture at a time when the early Christians were contending with other traditions and competing for members. This is precisely the view of some Christian scholars today. I once had the good fortune to meet the New Testament scholar Elaine Pagels, whose work I'd read in college. It is her view that the more authentic teachings of Jesus are found in a work called the Gospel of Thomas, that is not part of the New Testament canon and that is older than the works in the New Testament, and that the Gospel of John, in which the verse about Jesus being the way, the truth, and the life appears, was written later and was a reaction against the more universalist teaching of the earlier Thomas. So this is possible. It's certainly a tempting view and a tempting interpretation to take, and I'm not entirely averse to it. But I'm also conscious of how central the teaching of the necessity of faith in Jesus alone is for many Christians. As mentioned earlier in connection with the Buddha avatar, as Vedantins we must show respect for the beliefs of others and not insist to them that the sacred figure they revere as their teacher and guide is something other than what they take him to be. At the same time, though, as Vedantins and as rational, compassionate people, we must avoid the conclusion that the cosmos is ruled by a sadistic tyrant who creates living beings by the billions only to condemn them to eternal suffering. So how do we solve this problem? I would suggest another route is possible that's drawn from the teaching of the next avatar we'll discuss, Sri Ramakrishna. Looking ahead to the teaching of Sri Ramakrishna, when he was lying on his deathbed, he proclaimed his identity as an avatar to Swami Vivekananda, who was then still known by his nirth name Narendranath Datta, Naran or Narendra. His precise words, as translated by Swami Nikhilananda, were, he who was Rama and Krishna is now in this body, Ramakrishna. According to Hindu tradition, while avatars are many in number, the divinity manifesting in these forms is one and the same. Again, Lord Krishna says, whenever dharma declines and adharma arises, then do I manifest myself. The I is singular, even if all the avatars collectively make up a multitude. And again, in whatever way living beings approach me, thus do I receive them. Krishna is here speaking as Purnavatar and as the Godhead itself. In the same vein, he tells Arjuna at the end of the Gita, abandon all dharmas and take refuge in me alone. I shall free you from all evils. When he says, take refuge in me alone, this is not to be taken to mean that only he, in that particular form, as the son of Devaki and Vasudeva, a form which would perish due to a hunter's misguided arrow, is the sole divine reality to whom we must go for refuge. He is speaking rather as the Supreme Being, who is fully manifested in and as that form, and in many other forms as well. I would suggest that this is how we should interpret the words of Jesus as recounted in the Gospel of John as well. That the I who says, I am the way, the truth, and the life, no one comes to the Father but through me, is the same I who says, in whatever way living beings approach me, thus do I receive them. All paths lead to me. Jesus, like Krishna, is speaking as the Supreme Self, the Paramatman, which is manifesting in and as Jesus, but which is not simply identical with any particular form. The singular being who manifests as many avatars is the way, the truth, and the life, without whom we cannot reach our potential divinity, the Heavenly Father within. I think this is the only way we can reconcile this teaching, so central to Christianity, with the Vedantic view. We must otherwise reject it as sand mixed in with the sugar of the authentic words of Jesus. Finally, we come to Thakur, to Sri Ramakrishna, the avatar of our contemporary age. The particular mission of this avatar, I believe, has been to show the harmony of religions by demonstrating through his multi-religious sadhanas the effectiveness of many paths in reaching God realization. A turning point in the life of Ramakrishna occurred when one of his gurus and mentors on his spiritual journey, a woman known as the Bhairavi Brahmani, came to believe that her disciple was an avatar. Hindu texts describe the attributes of an avatar, thus making it possible to determine if a particular individual might be one. Ramakrishna was filled at an early age with a longing to see God, to perceive God directly. This longing intensified after he became a priest at the temple of Kali in Dakshineshwar. After days of intense prayer and deep emotional turmoil, Ramakrishna experienced the Mother Goddess as a living reality, manifesting as a limitless, infinite, effulgent ocean of consciousness. In the months that followed, he conceived a desire to experience the divinity in as many forms as possible, taking up the disciplines of various Vaishnava, Shaiva, and Shakta traditions of Hindu spiritual practice. It was in the course of these sadhanas or spiritual disciplines that the Bhairavi Brahmani became his guide. And I have a quote here from the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna. Day after day, she watched his ecstasy during the kirtan, the singing of sacred hymns, and meditation, his samadhi, his mad yearning, and she recognized in him a power to transmit spirituality to others. She came to the conclusion that such things were not possible for an ordinary devotee, not even for a highly developed soul. Only an incarnation of God was capable of such spiritual manifestations. She proclaimed openly that Sri Ramakrishna, like Sri Chaitanya, a great saint of Bengal, also proclaimed to be an avatar, was an incarnation of God. The Bhairavi Brahmani's faith that Ramakrishna was an incarnation is widely held in our tradition. But our tradition has no dogma or creed to which we are all required to give our assent. Individuals in Vedanta are free to express skepticism about this or any teaching. One such skeptic was Swami Vivekananda, though he would later come to believe very deeply in his teacher's divinity. But he never insisted that adherents of Vedanta accept this idea, and discouraged others from insisting too much on it. The idea with which the concept of the avatar rests in tension is the idea that all beings are divine. The ultimate aim of Vedanta is the realization of the divine potential in every being. One could suggest that an avatar is simply a person who has fully realized and manifested this divine potential. We will all someday be avatars from this point of view. There's a distinction, though, in Hindu traditions between one who ascends to the level of enlightenment and becomes God-realized, that is, jivan-mukta, liberated in this lifetime, and a descent or avatara of the Supreme Being. Indeed, Sri Ramakrishna himself corrected the young Naran's thinking in this regard while on his deathbed. Narendranath, too, was thinking an avatar must be essentially a liberated soul, a jivan-mukta, like the Buddha or Adi Shankara. According to the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, as Ramakrishna's body was racked with cancer, quote, after one or two days, Narendra said to himself, only if in the midst of this racking physical pain he declares his Godhead, then only shall I accept him as an incarnation of God. It was a passing thought, but the master smiled. Gathering his strength, he distinctly said, he who was Rama and Krishna is now in this body, Ramakrishna, but not in your Vedantic sense. Narendra was stricken with shame. There is indeed a sense in which we're all avatars. As Sri Aurobindo has shown, divine consciousness has descended, the literal meaning of avatar being descent, into this world of matter in the form of all of our individual centers of awareness. It has become, to use Swamiji's and Aurobindo's term, involved in the realm of time, space, and causation. Our aim, in turn, is to ascend, to evolve, to the highest limit of our potential, to God realization. The idea of the avatar, however, reassures us that we're not alone in this process. Just as we strive upward to ascend to our highest ideal, the highest divinity also descends to meet us with an outstretched hand, to lift us from the ocean of rebirth, the torment of delusion and suffering, and raise us to the level of divinity that is our birthright. In the words of the Christian Saint Athanasius, the Son of God became man so that we might become God, so that we might manifest that divinity which resides in a potential state within each and every one of us. Okay. I think we will have some meditation, shall we? So I'll ask you to keep your back straight and close your eyes and meditate briefly. We are going to just meditate for a couple of minutes. Breathe deeply and focus your mind on the divinity within your heart. Asato ma sad gamaya, tamaso ma jyotir gamaya, mrityor ma mritam gamaya. Om shanti, shanti, shanti. Lead us from the unreal to the real. Lead us from darkness to light. Lead us from death to immortality. Peace, peace, peace be unto all.